everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Tuesday, December 5th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so, as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me for the Tuesday edition of the show. Two guests join me today. The first, Alex Nicholas from Minor Rush, the SB Nation home of the UTEP Miners. We're going to talk Conference USA in both college basketball and college football here. Conference USA very, very well represented in the bowl season, even though UTSA, with six wins, was kept out of bowl action. So we'll talk about all of those matchups, also a little bit on the hardwood as well. Second half of today's show, Philip Rosenreich rejoins the show here from Orlando Magic Daily, also has national bylines at the Step Back and Talking 10 for Big Ten College Athletics. We'll chat with him about the NBA here. We had some very big home road disparities out there so far, so we'll touch on that a little bit, try to explain that phenomenon. We'll also take a look at some buy low and sell high types of teams using some of the stats and using some of the advanced metrics that are out there. Also have a little bit of a discussion about advanced metrics in the NBA overall as well. Really looking forward to that here with Philip on today's show. Before we get to that, over at bangthebook.com, plenty of content coming your way, churning out lots of great things day in and day out. My NFL and college football opening line reports are out. NFL, of course, week 14. College football, the Army-Navy game this week, and then also the bowl season. So I talked about some of the initial line moves that we've seen. And I'm going to use that opening line report concept to update the bowl season line moves as we go throughout each week here. So obviously those aren't opening lines anymore, but we're going to update what's going on with those, some of the action we've seen, injuries, suspensions, coaching changes, all that type of stuff. Also put up my final college football power ratings for the 2017 season, including all of my bowl numbers. I'll be referencing those here on the show. Those are pure power ratings numbers. They don't factor in motivation. They don't factor in coaching changes, bowl locations, any of that stuff. Just the raw, pure numbers. So check that out over at bangthebook.com, as well as Parker Michaels' NHL picks, my NHL and NBA situational betting articles, tons of stuff going on over there. We are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. Finally, this and every edition of Bang the Book Radio presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. If you use that promo code BTB and the number 25, you get a $25 free bet just for signing up. 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook. 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino as well. At BetDSI, it's only a game until you bet it. Two guests coming your way here today. The first, Alex Nicholas from Minor Rush, the SB Nation home of the UTEP Miners. Alex, how's it going today, man?
Good morning, man. Can't complain. Can't complain.
We got lots of stuff to talk about here on today's show. And I know you've been rather busy here of late. We're going to break up the basketball here a little bit by starting with college basketball. Then we'll get into college football and the bowl games. Last week, I wanted to get you on the Tuesday show. Timing certainly not in our favor there with that because of the surprising announcement that Tim Floyd stepping down as the head coach of UTEP. Give us some idea of how everything's going down there in El Paso with this program right now.
Woo, man. You know, for the first time in a while, I actually went to that game as a fan. I didn't go cover it. You know, I didn't sit press side. I was kind of, you know, the fan in me was frustrated. And that was just, that came out of nowhere. And it was just, I felt that Tim Floyd maybe, you know, retired at halftime because you're playing, you're getting rolled in front of, against the Mar, a game that you paid for as a guarantee game. And there's about 2,000 UTEP fans in there, and it was a sad sight to see, you know, UTEP basketball kind of fall that way. And you know, it's just kind of that way the athletic season has gone, as you know very well. Sean Coogler stepped down 5 games into the season, and Tim Floyd lasted 6 games into the season. So, you know, right now the program is very, very fragile in terms of emotion, in terms of, you know, pretty much any type of identity or any type of wins-loss situation that could happen. Still a long way to go, which is the crazy thing about it. But, I mean, right now the easiest way to describe it is the program is just in complete shambles at this moment, even though they were able to kind of salvage what was a tough week last week and ended out with the win against rival New Mexico, who's kind of struggling themselves. So right now there's just more question marks in the air than answers right now when it comes to UTEP basketball.
Yeah, that's a nice win over New Mexico, even though the Lobos have dropped off. I mean, this isn't the New Mexico team that people remember from 3 or 4 years ago that was a fixture in the tournament. They have fallen off quite a bit. Tough game here coming up for UTEP against Washington State. That game will come your way on December 9th. Then 10 days off, a game against Howard, the holiday break, and then you get into conference play. Is UTEP a fade team in your mind, or do you feel like now that they've gotten a win, they'll have 10 days off to do, or 9 days off to do some practicing? Do you feel like they can kind of rally a little bit? Because, I mean, this is a team that doesn't play a road game until January 4th, so, or at least a true road game until January 4th. So, you know, what do you think in terms of this team long term? I mean, could they be a little bit undervalued or just stay away?
I think in some matchups they can. That kind of the main thing kind of depends is when Matt Wilms comes back, UTEP's fifth-year center, you know, guy that's been oft injured, you know, pretty much throughout his whole career. That's kind of where UTEP's problems stem this season is once Wilms went out, the buckets got a little bit harder to get inside. Defensively, there was no rim protector. So he's kind of that X factor. Like you mentioned, UTEP has a favorable schedule over the next 3 or 4 weeks before conference play hits. So that, there's a possibility in some matchups if Wilms is back, which he could be back, you know, by the before that Christmas break that you mentioned. So I think there could be some value. I would look at lines. I would look at matchups, particularly early on in the year where UTEP might be playing. I think it's North Texas, you know, early on in the season, that UTSA swing. That's kind of some games I feel UTEP could keep it close depending on what that line spread is. But I think that's a team that, you know, based on matchups, based on, you know, how they're playing, and based on Matt Wilms, if Matt Wilms doesn't come back, I would stay away from this team for sure because you just don't know what you're going to get out of the UTEP basketball team. You could get 88 points like you did against New Mexico, or you could get a 50-point, 60-point effort like they did against New Mexico State. So it's going to come down to matchups for them in terms of anybody wants to get action on them and being confident and investing in a UTEP team right now that's just as much, probably the most up-and-down team in the nation, or at least in mid-major basketball right now.
All right, let's talk about the conference as a whole here. I mean, last year, Middle Tennessee State, phenomenal basketball team, won 30 games, 17-1 in conference play. This is a team that lost a couple of pieces and parts, though, and they've got a big transfer in Nick King who came in from Alabama, who it was kind of a bit player, a part-time player at his previous two stops at Memphis and Alabama, and now all of a sudden he's dropping 20 a game for the Blue Raiders. Are they still the class of this conference, or, you know, have their losses from last season, or have they kind of leveled the playing field here a little bit?
No, I still think they're a favorite. You know, they lost a very, very tough game to Belmont. And Belmont, as everybody knows, that's, you know, bets on college basketball. I mean, Belmont's a team that's, you know, very tough and a team that a lot of people, we get some play on that. So I still think, you know, the biggest thing for Middle Tennessee, when I look at, you know, not so much scores, but, you know, just looking at the way that they've gone about themselves, they've built themselves that identity of being that team that's going to be there every year, regardless if they have, you know, changes. And, you know, this is the second straight year that they've had a very talented transfer that's already making impacts early on in the season. And I think you're just going to see them continue to roll. You know, the next couple of weeks, they'll be definitely tested with some SEC talent, three straight SEC games, Vanderbilt, Ole Miss at home, and then Auburn, and then they'll have Princeton open up a tournament that they're playing in. So I think for right now, as far as a 5-1 start, you know, that could be said that that's just the way that Middle Tennessee goes about their business. But to see if they're still the upper echelon class, and not only the upper echelon class of Conference USA, but in mid-major basketball, I think the next three weeks before conference play will really, really answer that question. And I think they can answer that question. You know, I just really feel that Kermit Davis has built that culture. He's built that program up to be able to expect to win three straight games against SEC opponents in the out-of-conference schedule. And if they're able to at least go 2-1 in that stretch, I would really, really think that this Middle Tennessee State team can go into Conference USA and make a run like they did last year. But don't sleep on Louisiana Tech either. That's a really, really talented team that I've been very, very impressed with, even though they rolled Miles College by 50 points. You're looking at some of these other games, that's a team that right next to Middle Tennessee really stands out to me. And Middle Tennessee and Louisiana Tech right now look like two teams that could be on a collision course, you know, to possibly knock on that door of getting Conference USA two bids come March.
Now, I love talking about Conference USA and college basketball, and we'll have you on once we get into conference play here. But I love talking about this conference because it's the way that the schedule is set up is very, very interesting, because this is a conference that goes all the way out to Norfolk with Old Dominion. You've got Marshall up in Huntington, West Virginia. You've got UTEP, obviously, in El Paso. You've got a team in Murfreesboro. You've got a team in Ruston, Louisiana, where Louisiana Tech is. You've got teams all over the map. You got a couple of schools in Florida as well. So the road games are grouped where you generally play, you know, geographically. You'll play at Florida Atlantic and FIU together. You'll play UTSA and UTEP together, that type of thing. So you can get a lot of good situational betting angles in this conference. So you want to try to find those trustworthy teams, those teams that, you know, maybe play really good defense that's going to travel well, those teams that can play with consistency. Are there any teams you see like that outside of Middle Tennessee and Louisiana Tech that, you know, could wind up being pretty good against the spread bets because, you know, they can play consistent basketball regardless of location?
I think three teams kind of stand out to me in that regard. Marshall, because they can fill it up. You know, defense travels, obviously, but Marshall's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum on that one. I think they're a team that can put up 80, 90 points at any time. Old Dominion under Jeff Jones has proven that they can lock you down and force you to play in the 50s and the 60s on the road, and that's hard for some team like a Marshall, like a Western Kentucky, and even so a Louisiana Tech to a certain extent. And UAB, those are the three teams that I feel that their style of play really travels. UAB defensively, you know, have two, what I think are two, you know, kind of low-end NBA prospects in Chris Coakley and William Lee, but still they're two talented guys that seem to show up every night and defend well and are able to get inside and score buckets. So I think those teams, those three teams are three teams that I would really watch in terms of matchups and kind of get some action. And another team, really, I'm going to go kind of left field on you just because Iowa, they bust me with a parlay last week because they were 29-point dogs against Oklahoma. I think they were 10-point or 11.5-point dogs against UT Arlington, and they covered. And that's North Texas. And I haven't seen much of North Texas this year, but those are two examples of an out-of-conference of their style of play and their new style of play, being able to go in there and hang with those type of teams. And, you know, looking at that 29-point, you know, game against Oklahoma, I knew North Texas was terrible. I didn't think North Texas was 29 points terrible with Oklahoma, and actually had a two-point lead with 5 minutes in the second half. So that's another team that I'm starting to kind of feel, going back to your question, that I can throw them in there with those top five teams that, you know, will be guys, there will be teams to keep an eye on depending on those matchups. And, you know, even UTSA to a certain extent because they defend very well. They have that kind of that high-powered offense in the sense too. So those are, you know, some teams that have been early on and I'm kind of, you know, doing some things in the out-of-conference that makes me think, going back to your question again, that those could be teams to really kind of ride or just teams to kind of keep an eye on depending on their matchups and depending on how they play in their last four up against, you know, their next two or three games, which could be winnable or they'll be heavy dogs. So those are some teams that I would definitely keep an eye on here early on in out-of-conference so far.
I like that you mentioned North Texas because those are the types of teams you want to look to isolate. A team that went 2-16 in conference play last year, 8-22 overall. So there aren't a whole lot of people looking at the mean green here coming into this season. And if they are dramatically better, and certainly the last two games look like they are dramatically better, you know, that's an undervalued commodity that you may be able to ride a little bit here up until the odds makers are able to adjust. So like I said, Alex, we'll try to get you on some more after the first of the year here once we get deep into conference play. And again, I love looking at Conference USA because of the travel situations, because of the teams that have just completely different styles here in this league. I think it's a really good league to look at for betting purposes. But let's transition over to college football here. I think we talked coming into the season. We kind of did a little bit of a Conference USA preview. I want to say it was maybe back in early August or something like that when we were looking at this league. And I was real excited about the prospects of Conference USA this year, kind of looking at them in the same light that I looked at the AAC about 3-4 years ago, where you were getting some very exciting coaches. You were starting to get some more playmakers, starting to get some better talent overall. This conference didn't disappoint this year. I mean, you've got 10 teams that won at least 6 games. UTSA, the only one not going to a bowl game with their 6-5 record. What do you think about this conference overall this year?
You know, I think that it proved a lot of situations, kind of proved a model for Group of Five programs across the nation, really. If you invest in your program like a North Texas, if you invest in your program like an FIU, if you invest in your program like a FAU and UTSA, you can get results that can really, really drive not only your fan base, but can drive up your recruiting and drive up your overall profile. And we saw that with Lane Kiffin. You know, we've seen that with Louisiana Tech to a certain extent with Lou Holtz, the hire they made a couple years ago, kind of going back. But I think that's the biggest thing that I take away overall, just from kind of that administrative standpoint. Is, you know, you put a little bit of money into your football program, you hire the right people, you give that person the proper resources to hire a staff, and you get a 10-3 season, a 10-3 revival season like FAU, an opportunity to, you know, be one of the best Group of Five teams in the nation, one of the best Group of Five offenses in the nation. And that's really what what kind of takes me away from everything, taking out the betting angle, taking out X's and O's. I think that was my biggest takeaway. And you see the results, you know, you see the results of those investments from these presidents, these boosters, these athletic directors. And now you have a competitive conference at the top. Obviously at the bottom, there's still a lot of work to do. But you know, that's really what tells me, you know, the most looking at this conference is, like you mentioned, 3 years ago, nobody knew anybody in this, or 4 or 5 years ago, nobody knew anything about this conference in terms of the new realignment. What was UTSA going to be? Old Dominion, who's that? Can La Tech, you know, compete at a higher level? They've been in the WAC for so long. And these questions were answered very quickly with, you know, simple investments, you know, simple changes that really turn these programs into kind of a bottom feeder conference. And now, you know, a team, like you said, that you can compare to the American Athletic Conference that's, you know, fighting for the quote-unquote group of six, you know, mantra. So I think that's kind of the biggest takeaway. And then you've seen what these coaches are able to do once they're in place with those resources. And that's why you have turnarounds like FIU, turnarounds like FAU, recruiting prowess like UTSA starting to show. So this conference as a whole is just really, really starting to evolve into, you know, I don't want to call it big-time college football, but they're taking big-time college football steps to bring college football to these smaller institutions that aren't getting love. But with nine teams, I think it's hard not to give Conference USA love this year.
And I think what I love is that you're in a position in the conference where we have a lot of young, creative, exciting offensive coordinators. And those are guys that can get a start in a league like this. And that's what we saw in the AAC with guys like Chad Morris, for example, comes over from Clemson, you know, very smart offensive mind. He had a lot of talent to work with at Clemson, but you see him building up this SMU program right away. You get a guy like Kendall Briles. And, you know, obviously we could talk on a whole different level about the things that happened at Baylor while he was there, but you can't deny the fact that the guy's a very smart offensive mind. It worked very well at Florida Atlantic. Seth Luttrell at North Texas, another one where you've got a guy that's just a smart, young, creative thinker. You got a guy in Graham Harrell who played the position at a high level in college. And all of that works for North Texas. And then, you know, then you try to start building up the other side of the ball. And I think Conference USA is a conference that should be on the rise. And now you've got a couple job openings with Rice and UTEP. You know, Charlotte's still a bottom feeder. Old Dominion made a bowl game last year, could have made a bowl game this year without all the injuries. So this is a league that has really grown by leaps and bounds, and that's exciting to see. And I think that we can kind of see that here with some of their bowl matchups and with some of the lines that are out there. We'll start with the New Orleans Bowl here between North Texas and Troy. North Texas, of course, lost the conference championship game to Florida Atlantic. Draws an interesting matchup here against Troy. I actually like this game quite a bit. Number Troy -5.5 out there in the market. My raw power rating number is Troy -2, so a little bit of value on the mean green. How do you feel like North Texas stacks up against Troy in this matchup?
You know, that you're right. That's a great matchup. It really, really is. You know, that's a matchup probably week 7, week 8 of the season. I'm probably wearing my hands together. Couldn't wait to watch that game. But I kind of like Troy as a favorite in this one. I think, you know, FAU kind of exposed kind of some deficiencies that North Texas has in terms of their physicality defensively. And I think that's something that Troy can expose and be able to hold that 7-point, 9-point lead if they're able to jump out in the fourth quarter with a physical run game, you know. And I think that's kind of the difference in this ball game is Troy's physicality up against North Texas is growing physicality. And I think that's – you'll see North Texas and Seth Litchell try to attack that in the offseason. You know, they've kind of been that team that you can kind of run on in Conference USA over the past couple of years. And, you know, they've kind of still held that, but their offense is great, you know. And if you get a guy like Mason Fine – that gets off to an early start, and the key for them is jumping out to an early lead. But if they're not able to do that, I really think Troy can cover that -5 for sure pretty easy. But either way, that's a really, 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 really good group of five matchup, and it's open up bowl season.
Yeah, it really is. And I like the point you made about Troy and their physicality. I mean, this is a Troy team, I think, allowed like 7 sacks or something like that last year, a few more here this year because they had some losses and some injuries on the offensive line. But you know, Neil Brown's done a phenomenal job building up that program. And I like this. I like to see two group of five teams with some helium going up against each other. You know, it's not like, I mean, you do have some middle tier group of five bowl games where you've got, you know, the third best team in one conference against the fourth best team in another. But this is one where you have two teams on the rise. You have two teams that can use those extra bowl practices that can also use this as a springboard for recruiting purposes. I mean, it's not a bad thing for North Texas to get some exposure in New Orleans. And obviously Troy having to fight with all the SEC schools and all that, you know, it's a decent thing for them as well to be there in New Orleans. So there's additional long-term ramifications for this game. Even if you don't want to bet this one specifically, watching these two teams going forward, you know, this is a bowl game that can really be a springboard for both of them.
Oh, couldn't agree more, especially with North Texas, the way that they've made rounds in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and they're recruiting over the past couple of seasons under Ted Littrell. I think this is a key game. This is a program game for them, you know, not so much, you know, okay, let's make sure that we finish out our season tight. A great season that they've had. I think really this is a game, you know, like you mentioned, you're going up against kind of an equal team that's rising in another group of five conference. And for North Texas, you win this game, I think you a lot of eyes turn your direction even more than they have because of the culture change that they've had over the past couple of seasons with Littrell.
All right, let's slide down one spot here on the rotation. That's the Cure Bowl between Georgia State and Western Kentucky. Western Kentucky right now a 5-point favorite here in this one. It has been a little bit of a down year for the Hilltoppers. We certainly expected some drop-off with Jeff Brohm going to Purdue. Mike White, still a phenomenal player there at quarterback. This is a really interesting line because Western Kentucky is a team that, as I mentioned, a lot of people, a lot of casual bettors that are going to play all the bowl games just because they're out there are going to remember Western Kentucky from last year. Georgia State, on the other hand, big-time surprise here to be in a bowl game. Sean Elliott's done a phenomenal job with that program to get them to 6 wins, 5-1 away from home, too, which is kind of remarkable here on, of course, this game being played in Orlando. So this is obviously a very neutral site game for these two teams. What do you think about this one, Alex? Do you like Western Kentucky here against Georgia State, or is this just one of those spots where we kind of see Western exposed for how they've dropped off?
I'm kind of on the fence on that one. You know, you can definitely make an argument for your latter point because of the way that they ended the season, that they got rolled by FIU. You know, they had a very good emotional win against Middle Tennessee, but they still finished out the season 1-3, or actually 1-4. So they didn't finish the season out that strong. But looking at this Georgia State matchup, I think they're more athletic. I think they're a little bit deeper. And I think they should win comfortably with that power run game that they have. But the third question has been all year is that, you know, or kind of the knock on them all year long. And I go back to, you know, when I saw them here against UTEP, games that they're supposed to win, you know, they tend to kind of shortcome in those games. And I think this could be another one of those in this bowl situation where, you know, Georgia State might be a little bit more happier and more excited and motivated to play than Western Kentucky. But then you look at the fact that, you know, a lot of these players on Western Kentucky's team have been in this bowl situation before over the past 2 or 3 years, and they played high-level football. So that kind of sways me either way to really think that this game is kind of unpredictable from a Western Kentucky standpoint of motivation and how these guys are rebounding. Like I mentioned, they finished out the season 1-4, not very ideal and not something that we've seen for Western Kentucky, because Western Kentucky has been a team that has really rolled towards the end of the season. That's why they've been able to rack up Conference USA championships. So this is a game, personally, I'd probably stay away from, just because of the way that Western Kentucky's been favored. You know, you feel good about Western. You feel like, oh, they have that pedigree. And then they kind of throw a dud. And I think we could kind of see them either start off that way, maybe not so much a game that they're just going to throw away, but I could see Western Kentucky kind of, you know, having to play from behind and not being a team that can able to kind of hold that 5-point lead that you need them to close out in the fourth quarter. So I would kind of stay away from this game just because we don't know which Western Kentucky team we're going to get here in this bowl game.
That's an excellent point, and that's something that we're going to talk about a lot here on the shows is motivation, and you do have to wonder about it for Western Kentucky, whereas Georgia State, like you said, they're thrilled to be there. They're going to prepare. They're going to game plan. That is a big equalizer here during the bowl season. All right, let's go ahead and go out to the New Mexico Bowl here. Marshall takes on Colorado State, this one in Albuquerque. Very interesting here. You've got this game at 5,350 feet of elevation. Colorado State is used to that. Marshall is not. My raw number on this game, Colorado State -3. But when you factor in the fact that Colorado State has been to New Mexico, is accustomed to the altitude, looks a lot more like this 5.5 number that's out there. That being said, this is a disappointing year for Colorado State. Marshall, happy to bounce back under Doc Holliday. Good for them to get back to a bowl game after a 3-9 season last year. How do you see this game, Alex?
You know, that's, I think that, you know, for Marshall, it's a tough draw in terms of travel. I mean, you know, you talking about earlier about Conference USA basketball. Well, you know, Conference USA bowl games, usually, you know, they're kind of regionally. This is the first time that I think anybody that probably isn't going out to Bahamas that's coming out west for a 1,000-mile trip. And I think that plays against Marshall, and not only that, but like you mentioned, the elevation, it is different. You know, we're here in El Paso, and sometimes you can kind of feel it. You know, even my Sunday softball league, when I'm trying to cure a hangover, I can feel that adjust, you know, that difference. So, you know, I think that's a tough one for Marshall. And Marshall, the thing about Marshall to keep them in this game and kind of a betting angle is they play defense. You know, they will play defense. And Colorado State, you know, this is a team that was known under, you know, McElwain and the other coach that they had before. I name slips my mind, but, you know, this is a team that's known to put up points, and they've kind of, I think they've gone back to that power run spread. So I think that's going to be a game that I would look at that kind of that over-under on that game more than that point spread. But I would think Colorado State would be a pretty, pretty comfortable favorite that I would probably invest in, because Marshall's traveling a little bit longer, because Marshall doesn't have that explosive offense that we're used to. Marshall's calling key in this game is defense, and the fact that they have not been able to put up points against really good defensive teams or athletic teams that can match up with them, I think that could get exposed, and Colorado State could easily cover that -5. But in this particular game, I would look to see what that over-under is. I think that could be probably the best play in terms of confidence in this game, because Marshall's going to kind of – they're going to slow the tempo down a little bit on offense, and they're a team that can really shut down the defense if their defense can dig in. So another thing for Marshall, they've had a lot of off-field issues, so I would keep an eye and make sure nobody gets suspended, over the next couple of weeks before that bowl game kicks off.
Last game here on December 16th, the Camellia Bowl in Montgomery, Alabama. Middle Tennessee State takes on Arkansas State, and – Alex, I got a real hard time with this game. My number on this one's Arkansas State -5, so a little bit higher than the 3.5 that's out there. I don't know what Middle Tennessee State is at this point, because they spent so much of the season without Brent Stock still. But what do you think about them here in this spot?
You know, I like them. I really like them, and I just read an article about Middle Tennessee, about how excited that they are, because, you know, you go back to a couple weeks ago when they were 4-6. You know, this is a team that was destined to finish out the season without a bowl, and, you know, would have been, you know, just very disappointing for a team that coming into the season was, you could probably pencil them in as one of the top offensive units nationally, not group of five, nationally with Richie James, with Brent Stocks. So, you know, for them sitting 4-6, you know, pretty much, you know, getting ready to just prepare for Christmas break. Now you're in a bowl game. So we're talking about motivation factors for top teams in the league, and Western Kentucky was able to limp in, so was Middle Tennessee. But I think Middle Tennessee's motivation factor is going to be huge in this one. Not only that, but when Brett Stocks is in there, as you know, Adam, this is a team that puts up 40 a game with them, and they proved that, you know, to end out the season, you know, the way that they played offensively and able to kind of get right, you know, after that 38-10 loss to Marshall, they finished out the season 4-1. So I think this team coming in, this Middle Tennessee State team, is coming in really hot. They're coming in motivated, and I think off of Arkansas State, who's, you know, not a pushover themselves, but I think this is a game where you see Middle Tennessee kind of surprise somebody with a 2-3 score win. And I think the fact that, you know, Brent Stockstill's coming back, and he felt like this is his last game, his exact quote in the article that I read just before I came on with you, you know, I think that's a huge motivation. I think Middle Tennessee is going to prepare well. I think they come out there, and I think they really, really put it to Arkansas State in this game.
I love Middle Tennessee's coordinators. Love Franklin, love Schaefer. Those could be the two X factors here in this game with, you know, a little bit of extra prep time here. Random side note, this kind of coming across the wire on Twitter as we're talking here. Rice has named Stanford offensive coordinator Mike Bloomgren as the head coach. So Rice going to want to play
nice
some
hire.
Power. Yeah, some power football here in Conference USA. That should be a pretty interesting thing, especially as we just talked about with all the offensive creativity and a lot of onus on skill position players and that type of thing. Interesting hire there for Rice. No offense to Florida Atlantic and Akron, but the Lane Train can put whatever number on the Zips he wants to. That number 22.5 in Boca, so we're not going to touch on that game. Let's jump ahead here to this Louisiana Tech SMU game real quickly. This one is the Frisco Bowl. This is a new bowl game that's been added here for this season. SMU doesn't have real far to go here for this one, being played at Toyota Stadium. Louisiana Tech's catching 5 here in this spot. My number's a little bit higher than that. Does Louisiana Tech match up well here to play an arms race with SMU, or not really?
You know, that's one of the most interesting overall bowl games, and I'm a group of five fan, so I that's appointment watching for me because of that factor. I feel Louisiana Tech can match up, but SMU has been just so greatly improved this season long, and really I think, you know, they're kind of underappreciated in American Athletic Conference, I think, of what SMU's been able to do. But Louisiana Tech, big deal all year long has been the quarterback spot. One game, Jamar Johnson looks like an all-star. The other game, he looks like a bona fide freshman. So this could be one of those games where these extra practices kind of play in a factor for Louisiana Tech, because they're taking, you know, a two-step up-notch in competition with SMU. And I think this is a game that you could see Louisiana Tech able to hang around. But Chad Morris has recruited well, and you can see the identity that he wants in terms of the tempo, in terms of their offense. And I think this is a game that, you know, that kind of upper echelon AAC team with a middle of the Pac Conference USA team. I think you see SMU kind of pulling away in this one, but still a very good matchup. And Louisiana Tech defensively, I think, can match up with anybody. It's just, can they hang offensively if this game turns into a shootout? And I'm talking about not more so putting up points, but more so can they take care of the football and give themselves an opportunity? And that's talking about Louisiana Tech. So that's kind of my question about Louisiana Tech. Louisiana Tech may be about a year away. I talk highly about Louisiana Tech coming to this season, you know, as a team that I thought would maybe be a dark horse in the Conference USA West. And, you know, I still think maybe they're a year away from that after watching them all season long. But they do match up athletically in terms of their defense, but offensively, I just think right now the big key in this game is one or two turnovers, and SMU could turn this one into a, you know, two-score win. But, you know, very interesting game that I'm definitely appointment watching here on December 20th for sure.
I want to touch on this game very, very quickly because the matchup doesn't intrigue me a whole lot, but it is easily the most awesome bowl game name ever. The Bad Boy Mowers Gasparilla Bowl in St. Petersburg, Temple and FIU. FIU catching a full touchdown here in this one, a little bit of extra juice on the Panthers. There really haven't been a whole lot of believers in FIU throughout the season. I mean, do we have reasons to believe in them?
I'm one of them that really hasn't. You know, I've looked at Temple for the past couple of years as, you know, one of those upper echelon, you know, American athletic teams. You know, I've voted them high in our underdog poll with Underdog Dynasty at SB Nation. And, you know, FIU, the jury's kind of still out on them. But going back to what we were talking about in North Texas and, the North Texas game, is this is another kind of recruiting war in a sense in terms of FIU. There's an arms race right now in Florida, you know, for recruiting with Lane. You know, I've heard Willie Taggart's name being thrown around at Florida State. You got a new head coach down there at Florida. So this is a game for me that I think maybe FIU's, you know, in terms of their motivation, that could be a factor in this one. But I still think Temple's kind of the more superior team in them. I could see them catching 7, even 10. You know, FIU is still a really, really good team. And Alex Magoo, you know, is a veteran quarterback. So I think that can kind of play in a factor. But the way that I've seen Temple over the past couple of years, you know, I'm still going to kind of doubt FIU in this one. And I would take Temple in that.
All right, how about we look at the Bahamas Bowl real quickly between UAB and Ohio. And UAB, the best story in college football. You and I have talked about this already. I've talked about it with a lot of guests here on the show. Thrilled for this team. Bill Clark's coach of the year, as far as I'm concerned. They get a trip to the Bahamas after everything that they've been through. That's absolutely phenomenal. I don't love this matchup for UAB. But the way that Ohio finished the regular season, losing to Akron as a double-digit favorite in a game that cost them a spot in the MAC title game, then losing to Buffalo in a game that didn't really matter to them, I'd be a little worried about the Bobcats laying 7.5 here.
I would too. I would too. And I think, you know, the big key in this one is UAB's ability to run the football. You know, that's going to be that changes that 7-point spread, you know, and, you know, officially to my mind, maybe a 4-point spread, because UAB can kind of shorten the game in certain situations and kind of kill clock. And not only that, but defensively, you know, they're one of the most physical teams in terms of their linebacker core. You know, and Akron's a team that, you know, that can put a point. So that's going to be an interesting matchup overall. And I think, you know, the key for that game, though, for UAB Ohio is UAB's run game. So I think the fact that UAB can run the ball can kind of trim that 97 that they're giving Ohio. But, I mean, what we've learned about the Bahamas Bowl over the past couple of seasons is anything can happen in the Bahamas. Those have been crazy bowl games. So it's going to be interesting to see if that factor can live up to it. But like I said, I kind of think UAB with their run game, they're not going to lose by 7 in that game. That's a game that I don't think that they'll be – I don't think that they can win that game, because like what you mentioned about Ohio, but UAB is going to keep that game closer than 7 points for sure.
One final game with Conference USA. This is the second biggest spread on the board. The other one's Florida Atlantic, of course. This one between – you know, this is such a fascinating game here for me between Southern Miss and Florida State in Shreveport, Louisiana. Florida State expects to go to the College Football Playoff. They expect to play on New Year's Day. They don't expect the Independence Bowl in Shreveport. However, it seems like they're going to come out and play for Odell Haggins. They're a 15-point favorite here. I mean, can Southern Miss hang? What do you think?
I think they can. You know, Southern Miss has proven that, you know, they have some pretty good athletes, you know, like Ito Smith, you know, like some of their wide receivers that they have out, Allen Zay Staggers, you know, a very talented player. And, you know, this is a team that's coming in. They've won three straight. You know, they hung in there with Marshall and played a tremendous game with Marshall. They were able to, you know, roll Charlotte and roll Rice in the last, you know, 3 weeks. And they hung in there with Tennessee over the past couple of years, the game before they rolled Rice. So this is a team that right now, I think confidence-wise, I think Southern Miss is riding high with confidence. But at the end of the day, their quarterback situation is something that scares me. And that's something that I think that you'll see Florida State defensively, their defensive athleticism kind of take over and put pressure and force Southern Miss to make mistakes. So while I think in a perfect situation, if Florida State comes out slow, you know, Southern Miss jumps out to an early lead, you know, 14-0 lead, 10-0 lead, something like that, that's Southern Miss's best opportunity. But if Florida State can really kind of dig in defensively and force that whoever's going to be under center for or out of the shotgun for Southern Miss to make mistakes, that's going to be a key. So I would kind of lean that, you know, Florida State's going to win the game while they cover. I'm kind of, you know, in between on that. But athletically, I think defensively, that's, you know, Florida State's key to being able to put this one away early is with their athleticism and getting pressure and making, you know, Southern Miss's quarterback situation's kind of been up in there all year long in terms of inconsistency. So I think that is kind of Southern Miss's downfall here in this bowl game.
Alex Nicholas from Minor Rush, the SB Nation home of the UTEP Miners. What do you guys got going on over there?
Right now, we finally get a week off of what's been a crazy past couple of weeks. But later this week, I'll have some updates on the UTEP football coaching job, you know, getting some interesting information from sources up there. Obviously, UTEP basketball is kind of a hot topic right now. Got some highlights from that New Mexico game. And then we'll have our preview later in the week on what should be a very interesting line that's going to come out between that Washington State and UTEP this weekend.
Well, and SBN Minor Rush is the Twitter handle for that blog, and then NicholasAlex915 on Twitter for you. Alex, thank you so much for your time, man. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon.
Yes, sir. Have a good one, Adam. Thanks, man.
A lot of good stuff there. Love that conference specialization angle to dig a little bit more into Conference USA. One more guest here joining us on today's show. That is Philip Rosenreich from OrlandoMagicDaily.com. Philip, how's it going today, man?
It's going good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Appreciate your time as always here, sir. I know it's nice for us to chat a little bit more consistently here, talk some NBA. Love to get your input and your analysis on the association. Before we dig into some of the topics that I want to touch on with you, and we're going to talk about some of the home road disparities that are out there and kind of look at some of those buy low, sell high types of teams. Since we last talked, we've seen about three, four, five games from these teams here, more than a quarter of the season done. Things pretty much shaking out the way that you expected them to.
Yeah. I think we're beginning to see, you know, the teams that we expected to make runs begin to kind of struggle in these games. And, you know, I'm sure since the last time we talked, we were talking about some of the struggles the Cleveland Cavaliers have gone through. Well, they're now on a 12-game win streak in their second place in the Eastern Conference, just where we all thought they were. So I think this is the part of the year where we begin to see kind of the wheat separate itself from the chafe. And I think we're beginning to see the standings settle into what they're going to be for the rest of the year. So we're seeing teams that are struggling begin to fade. We're seeing teams that are going to succeed begin to surge. And, you know, the rest of the season's getting set right now. So the standings are looking pretty much what we all expected. I mean, a few surprises out there still for sure. But I think teams are settling into their identities and kind of putting themselves in position for the stretch run right now as we get through the middle of the season.
Well, and I'm glad that we saw it play out that way, because that was something that we talked about. I think it was on last week's segment. It may have been one of the segments before that. But as you mentioned, you know, the NBA schedule started about a week and a half, 2 weeks earlier than usual. So where people generally think of Christmas Day as being, you know, the unofficial start of the NBA season, there were games played, you know, earlier this year than in past years. So you mentioned, I think it was, like I said, the last time we talked, that, you know, you figure we'd start to see some of those teams that are expected to be at the top start to make some moves. Boston's won 3 in a row, Cavs 12 in a row, Raptors 3 in a row, Pistons have dropped 3 straight, so they've fallen back a little bit. You know, the Rockets playing very well with 7 in a row, Warriors 4 in a row for them, Spurs 7 of their last 10. So pretty much playing out the way that you kind of anticipated that it would the last time we talked. So kudos to you for that. And in terms of looking overall here at the standings, one of the things that really stands out to me in a big way, you've got some teams that have some massive, massive home road disparities in terms of how they've fared at home and how they've fared on the road. The Knicks, 10-5 at home, 1-7 on the road. I know Madison Square Garden's not the easiest place for teams to play, different sight lines, older building. I know it's a point of contention when you talk about college games being played there. There are a couple of those going on tonight, coincidentally. But what do you attribute that to? The fact that the Knicks have played so well at home and just awful on the road.
You know, I think you see this with a lot of young teams, especially where they play, they're much more comfortable playing in their own environment rather than going out on the road. You know, I'm not sure what the splits are on Kristaps Porzingis playing. I know when the Knicks came to Orlando earlier this year, he didn't play, and he obviously didn't play Sunday in a home loss to the Magic. And so, you know, I think what with the Knicks is just a matter of comfort, and that's the case with a lot of teams. And the Knicks are a fairly young team. I mean, they got some veterans like Courtney Lee, and Kristaps Porzingis is obviously a big piece, but that's still a pretty young team and a pretty new team. And so any comfort advantage you can create does help the team. I mean, I think it's demonstrable over time. And although there's been some studies to suggest that home court advantage has kind of faded a little bit, this year is bucking that trend a little bit. And the Knicks, you know, are playing really, really well at home. I mean, I think again, it's just this defense. You're right, the sight lines in Madison Square Garden are a little bit different. Everyone's a little bit nervous. Everyone kind of feels how big it is to play in the Garden. I mean, it sounds kind of cheesy for an NBA player to say, but NBA players constantly say there's something different about playing in the Garden. And so maybe that little bit of mystique gives the Knicks a little bit of an advantage because that's their every day. They're used to playing in that environment. And if it is indeed a special environment to be in, then it's obviously very, very different for teams that have to deal with it for the first time.
And it's been fascinating, too. I mean, this isn't just a straight-up stat with the Knicks. They've played very well against the spread at home as well. They fell to 2-6 against the spread on the road this season, but they're 11-3 at home against the spread. So they've been a moneymaker at Madison Square Garden for those that have hopped on that trend, and we'll see if that is something that's able to continue. Let's talk about the Charlotte Hornets. You had a chance to watch the Charlotte Hornets last night. They topped your Orlando Magic 104-94, covered the 7.5-point number, winning by 10, but took a fourth quarter flurry to do it. They won the fourth quarter by 9, won the game by 10. So this was a close game here coming into the final period, but Charlotte improving to 8-3 at home, and also 8-3 against the spread at home. They are 1-10 away from the friendly confines. So what is it about Charlotte this year?
Yeah, I mean, well, Charlotte is coming off of a four-game losing streak where they didn't have Kemba Walker. And I think that's been – obviously, Kemba Walker is absolutely tuned back into the fold. You can tell he's still a little rusty and still getting his feet under him. But, you know, really, I think the big thing with Charlotte is you know, there's this perception that you don't get calls when you're on the road. You don't get the foul. You don't get the benefit of the whistle when you're on the road. And there's actually been some studies suggest that this is kind of true. You know, peer pressure from the crowd does affect officials. They are human after all. And so you do tend to see a little bit of favoritism toward the home team, when you're on the road. And that's just kind of a fact of life. And Charlotte, if I'm not mistaken, Charlotte leads the league in free throw rate. They are a team that relies heavily on getting to the foul line. And so it would make sense that they play better at home because they're able to get to the foul line more. I mean, one of the big storylines coming out of last night's game against the Magic, or at least from the Magic's perspective, was how often Charlotte got to the free throw line. Charlotte got 40 free throw attempts in yesterday's game, 14 from Kemba Walker. I believe he had 8 in the fourth quarter. That's a huge disparity, and that's a huge advantage that Charlotte has. They did not play a great offensive game, but they were able to generate points from the foul line, get the Magic in foul trouble, really frustrate them on defense, and that had a whole big effect on the game. And so I think that part of it is very, very real. But, you know, Charlotte's a team that just doesn't have a lot of depth right now either. I mean, outside of Kemba Walker, who's scoring on that team, and when he goes out of the game, Charlotte's offense just goes in the tank. And so relying on that on the road is not a good prospect. I mean, obviously, they're 1-10 on the road. And so Charlotte has to kind of figure out how to find some secondary scoring. They need Batum back healthy. You know, maybe they need a little bit more from Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. You know, Malik Monk didn't play yesterday, so maybe they're missing him a little bit right now. There's a lot. There's a lot up in the air in Charlotte. They kind of know who they are. You know, they're obviously kind of skating on the outside of the playoff race right now. But you know, this is a team that could turn it on very, very quickly, especially if Walker gets going and he gets the help that he needs.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be upset too if I was a Magic fan. 40 free throw attempts for Charlotte, 14 for Orlando in that game last night, and that ultimately was the difference in the game with a 10-point win for Charlotte. So maybe Charlotte Backer is getting a little bit fortunate there. So let me ask you this, Philip. I mean, I'm not all that well-versed in basketball statistics, and I kind of wonder about this. So teams that foul a lot, I mean, there are teams in the NBA that foul a lot more than others. It's just whether it's the way that they play defense or because, you know, they just they don't care about sending the other team to the line or whatever the case may be. Is that a sustainable thing to look to play on Charlotte against teams that foul a lot, or is fouling just a really high variance statistic?
You know, fouling is a really high variance statistic. I mean, I don't think you can pinpoint and say, oh, this is a team that fouls a lot. There are teams that give up a lot of free throws, and those are typically your teams that are bad at defense. I mean, I think when it comes to fouling, you know, when you're looking at teams that commit fouls rather than teams that draw fouls, when you're looking at teams that commit fouls, it's going to swing wildly depending on the opponent. But typically, those are teams that are not good at defense. You know, I haven't looked at the statistics, and maybe I can grab them here while I'm talking. But I would venture to guess that the teams that are at the bottom of the league in free throw rate allowed, which is the essentially a ratio of free throw attempts over field goal attempts. I would venture to guess that the teams that give up the most free throws per game are also the teams that are the worst on defense. And you know, maybe that doesn't bear out. I'm seeing the Philadelphia 76ers are actually the worst team in the league at opponent free throw rate, and they're actually a pretty good defensive team. So maybe that doesn't bear out. But again, Philadelphia is also a young team, so they're going to make a lot of mistakes. So essentially, you know, I view fouling as a defensive mistake that you make for the most part. It's because you're late on a rotation, you're out of position, you know, whatever the case may be. I typically view that as a defensive mistake. So, you know, more likely than not, you got to look at kind of the other side, which teams are able to get to the line, which teams are able to draw fouls, and how does that match with the defense they're playing? I mean, you look at a team like Houston with James Harden, or you look at a team like Charlotte with Kemba Walker, or Minnesota with the Jimmy Butler. Those are guys that put a lot of pressure on your defense and force you into those mistakes that draw fouls. And it may not necessarily matter who the opponent is. These teams may not shoot 40 free throws all the time, but they'll constantly be up at 20, 25, 30 free throw attempts per game. And that obviously gives you a better chance to win. It gives you some cushion if your offense isn't good enough to maybe sustain itself in the half court.
All right, let's talk about the Toronto Raptors here real quickly. I know I didn't mention them in the email, but they do have a little bit of a home road disparity here. They're 8-1 at home, 6-6 on the road, but they are only 5-4 against the spread at home. So they haven't been covering the number with any sort of high efficiency, but they have been winning a lot of home games. And I just want to ask, you know, one of the things about the NBA, you look at cities like Toronto, you look at cities like Los Angeles, you look at cities like Miami, not real easy places to play. You've got athletes that have a lot of money, you know, they want to go out and do things. They'll go out and hit up the nicest clubs, the nicest restaurants, all those extracurricular activities that pro athletes do. Is that the case for Toronto here, where they're just, you know, in a good situation where, you know, they're in a city that has a good nightlife, or is there more to the fact that they are 8-1 at home?
You know, I don't think it's quite like Los Angeles and Miami. I mean, I joked with some friends after the Warriors beat the Magic. You know, I had heard that the Warriors were getting Saturday off in Miami, and I was like, well, they're not winning Sunday. They ended up winning Sunday, of course, because of the Golden State Warriors. But, you know, I don't think that that's necessarily the case in Toronto. I think Toronto just has a good home court advantage. I mean, their fans, you know, they're probably not in full-throated playoff form already, but they have a great fan base. They put a lot, you know, they provide a lot of energy in that building. And Toronto's a really good team. I mean, let's kind of be real here. There are a lot of these home road splits, and they're normal. I mean, most coaches will say win all your home games, make up the difference on the road. So, you know, I think kind of you look at these home road splits, and it's a chicken or an egg problem. Are they good at home because, you know, there's a real home court advantage or all that? Or are they good at home because they're actually a pretty good team and they're still, you know, kind of struggling to get it out on the road? Or, you know, they're they're going to be about a 500 team or maybe a little bit better on the road too. So I think that's kind of the issue here. Toronto is a really good team. I mean, they've obviously climbed up to third in the Eastern Conference at 14-7. And they haven't even played a lot of their games at home right now. So I just think that you got to kind of take both into consideration. Toronto has always had a very tough home court. Air Canada Center has always been tough, especially during this run. And then that's just a very tough team to play. And so when you get a good team where it's comfortable, they're going to perform. And so I think we're seeing them perform very, very well here in the early part of the season.
I think a big portion of it, too, is geographic, because I look at this a lot in the NHL. One of the better home ice advantages, one of the better plays lately, has been playing the Carolina Hurricanes in Raleigh, because generally speaking, you either play a standalone road game in Raleigh because there's not really much else around, or you're coming off of playing in Florida against Tampa Bay or Florida. You're coming off of playing against Washington, which, the Capitals have been such a great team for so long. So you go and play in Raleigh, and it's kind of a flat spot for you. It's kind of one of those difficult places to play. I kind of wonder if Toronto falls under the same umbrella, because a lot of times if you're going to Toronto, maybe you're playing in Boston before that, or you're playing in Boston next. Philadelphia now all of a sudden is a place where teams are excited to go because you're playing this, this really good Philadelphia young team. The Knicks, if you play in New York, guys love to go to New York. Guys love to be in the spotlight, that type of thing. So maybe that's part of it too with Toronto. And there are situations like this where, you come off of playing somewhere you really want to play. You go somewhere where you're not sure if you want to play there. Charlotte is an example of this. You play Miami and Orlando and, maybe in Atlanta or Washington, something like that. Then you go to Charlotte. Well, maybe you don't get up for that game as much as you would somewhere else. So I think that plays a big role too.
And that's an interesting point too, because I it might be interesting to study how teams play on back-to-backs coming to or from Toronto, because not only let's say are you going to Toronto, and however you feel about that city, back in Philadelphia, and you're heading to Toronto on a 7 o'clock game ends at 9:30, you're on the bus at 10, you're on the plane maybe around 11. You fly, you land at 1. Instead of just getting off the plane and going straight to the hotel, you got to go through customs, and that might be another 30 or 40 minutes. So, that you're losing some sleep opportunity there just because of the process of leaving the country. And maybe that difference isn't as pronounced in the NHL when you go to Toronto, and then you go to Ottawa, you go to Montreal, you do a little road trip in Canada before coming home. In the NBA, you make that one trip to Toronto, you got to go through customs on the way in, you got to go through customs on the way out. And that takes away from, some sleeping time for these teams, that especially in the league now where they're really valuing sleep and sleep opportunities, that's time you can't, get back and some rest that you don't get.
And I'm a big believer in circadian rhythm. I'm a big believer in playing on those situational spots where you're traveling across time zones, where you have, some of those interruptions, like going through customs and all that. And it's fascinating for me to study that type of stuff. I'm very, very interested in it. It helps from a betting standpoint, but also, one of the growing trends that I've seen here this year is that teams aren't flying out right after games anymore like they used to. They're getting a good night's sleep in the city they just played in and then flying out in the morning. Now, I don't know how teams are doing that situation with back-to-backs. Maybe they are still flying out right away, but that is something I thought was pretty interesting, that when you're on a road trip, if you've got that off day in between, instead of spending that off day all in the city where you're going to play next, you just sleep in the city you just played in, travel the next day, and then have, half a day or three quarters of a day, whatever, in that new locale. So I love looking into stuff like that, and I'm glad that, NBA and NHL teams are doing so as well.
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, any advantage you can get, if you can study it and prove you can prove something, teams are more receptive to that than ever before. I mean, the NBA requires teams to be in the city they're playing the night before, so you're not going to completely eliminate a lot of these no sleep days. But I mean, I've heard of more teams than ever deciding to stay. Like, I know the Magic, when they took a West Coast trip a few weeks ago, they decided to stay in Portland an extra night and fly back the next day, which they were going to have off anyway, to make sure players got a good night's sleep in a bed rather than on a plane, and then be back in Orlando for kind of a full day to be refreshed for practice the following day. So we're seeing a lot of teams do that. I mean, Golden State, they took this East Coast trip. They actually flew to Orlando on the day before the game, practice kind of a early evening practice when they got in, and then took the morning off the day before. So I think we're seeing a lot of teams try these different tactics to find rest for their players and make sure they get their sleep.
All right, let's go across to the Western Conference here, and two very obvious home road disparities: Denver and Utah. I mean, when you play in altitude, it is what it is. You should be good at home. Denver has been 10-2. Utah has been 11-4. But a combined 5-15 road record here: Denver 3-8, Utah 2-7. There's more to it than just going from the altitude to going to sea level, or going to a different city. What do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I think with both teams right now, it's a little bit of their overall streakiness. Obviously, again, Utah has a great home court advantage. It's not just altitude, but Utah's always been a very good home team. Denver the same way. Denver has always, the altitude probably has a lot to do with it, but Denver's always been a very difficult team to play on the road. Denver, when you catch teams on a back-to-back in altitude, you're gonna steal some games. You're gonna get some schedule losses that maybe you wouldn't otherwise. But I think both teams right now, I would hold off maybe on buying in so much on the home road split, at least for Denver, because Denver's obviously going through some injuries right now. Nikola Jokic is out. Paul Millsap is out. They're kind of going through a little bit of struggle. And so I wouldn't be surprised if their road record gets a little worse right now, because I know they're getting ready to take a long road trip. They're going to be in Orlando on Friday. So struggle a little bit away from home. Again, it's about that comfort thing, especially for young teams. They feel more comfortable at home. It doesn't disrupt their rhythms. It's nothing they have to adjust to. They know where everything is. They're in nice, comfy locker rooms for the NBA home teams. Those things are little advantages that matter. And I mean, again, you're going to see home teams typically do better than road teams. I mean, that logically makes sense, and it plays itself out over the course of a season. But a team like Denver that, is going through injuries, they're going to struggle a lot more on the road than they do at home, because they need every little advantage that they can get. And, the altitude is part of it. Utah, on the other hand, I mean, I think they're a team that's primed to see themselves bounce back on the road right now. They're playing some great basketball. They're on a 6-game win streak. Donovan Mitchell, the rookie, is playing really, really well. They're just about – I think they got Rudy Gobert back last night. They've always been a very, very good home team. And some of that, I think, is – comfort. Some of that might be getting some of the whistles that you typically get at home, because they run such a motion-based offense. So I think eventually we'll see Utah bring that road record back up if they can sustain this high level of play that they're playing.
All right, let's talk about San Antonio for a second. San Antonio 11-2 at home. This isn't a big surprise. This is a team that went 40-1 at home a couple of years ago. What does surprise me a little bit is the 5-6 road record. And I know Kawhi Leonard's been hurt. Is that the primary root cause of it, or is there something more to it?
I think it is a little bit. I mean, it's not just that Kawhi Leonard's been hurt. It's Tony Parker's been in and out of the lineup. And mostly out of the lineup. It's been a lot of those things. And the Spurs this year are relying on a lot of young guys that they haven't really had to rely on very much. Your Deontay Murray's, your Kyle Anderson's. There are a lot of guys that aren't longtime Spurs guys or longtime rotation players with the Spurs that San Antonio is trying to integrate in and build up. And again, it's that confidence thing. When you're on the road and the crowd's not for you, how much do you still buy into the system? How much confidence do you have? And so, I think San Antonio is a team that knows how to pace itself through the season. So it isn't a huge concern that they're not winning on the road quite yet. I mean, they're obviously still third in the West, but I think that's a number that's going to change. That's going to reverse itself once Kawhi gets back, once Tony Parker gets back into the swing of things. Once they kind of get their feet under them, they've had to play with a lot of injuries early this year, and that's clearly shown.
One more team I want to talk about here with a home road disparity, and a couple of these losses have come in altitude, but that's the Oklahoma City Thunder. And obviously the Thunder have done a lot of things to try and figure out some team chemistry and try to get this thing squared away. But they are 8-3 at home, just 2-9 on the road. What's the story there, you think?
I think the story there is they don't quite know who they are yet, and that's tough to travel when you don't quite know who you are. They're still trying to figure out how to make Russell Westbrook, Paul George, and Carmelo Anthony work. Billy Donovan is still working through his rotations. And that's just a team that hasn't quite figured it out yet, and you can tell when you watch them. Like, sometimes there are moments of absolute brilliance, and you're more likely to see that brilliance at home. you know, again, like it's about that comfort. On the road, it just hasn't traveled yet. And while their defense has been really good, they're struggling in crunch time. They're struggling late in games. So I, without looking too deeply at their results, I would imagine a lot of those 9 losses on the road came in close games where Oklahoma City is really struggling right now. They can't seem to generate consistent offense or generate the right kind of rhythm that they need late in games to pull out wins. So I would imagine that Oklahoma City's record is very variable. I mean, they're going to go through a stretch where they win a lot of these close games, or, you know, they start figuring things out, and that's when I think we'll begin to see Oklahoma City zoom up the standings. I don't think it's time to sell your Oklahoma City stock quite yet, but there are definitely some problems that they're still trying to figure out and trying to work out that they haven't figured out yet. And, you know, your flaws get exposed a lot more on the road than they do at home. And so I think that that Oklahoma City's flaws are being exposed more on the road.
Interesting line here tonight with Oklahoma City. They take on these surging Utah Jazz, as you mentioned, 6 in a row for them. Oklahoma City is favored by a touchdown tonight, and they haven't covered a game against a Northwest Division opponent yet this year. So interesting to see them as a 7-point favorite, but, you know, obviously the odds makers know what they're doing. We've found that out several times over here throughout the lifetime of Bang the Book Radio. Philip, I want to shift gears here and ask you about something. And I kind of think about, like I said, I like situational handicapping. I like looking for those travel spots and those types of things. One of the big concepts is revenge games. Do you feel like over the course of the NBA regular season, those are a thing?
You know, I think fans tend to overstate them, but I do kind of think that there is such a thing as a revenge game. I mean, you're in an 82-game season, and not every game is going to be your best game. There are a lot of basketball games over the course of a long season. So you're not always going to be, say, up for every game, as some might say. You're going to find those games that just feel like your Tuesday game that just is kind of on the schedule. And, you know, I kind of joke especially with good teams, there are ho-hum games where it's just like, oh, you know, the team showed up. They didn't play particularly well. They didn't play particularly bad, but they won. So that's just kind of a ho-hum Wednesday game. There are definitely those games. And so when you get the opportunity to kind of get up for an opponent, whether it's a big game that's on national TV, a TNT game, or and while, you know, I'm a proponent of saying every game counts the same, they're all 1 of 82, when you're a growing team that's never been on TNT, there's a different energy in the building. I think very real feeling to being on national TV if you're a team that's not really on national TV very much. Those games matter. Not only do the teams make them matter as far as from a marketing perspective, I think players know those games matter. And so when you get down to it, basketball is such a kind of free-flowing game. There are ways that individual players can make huge impacts. And obviously there's kind of a culture around it too, where you see it on Twitter all the time with the personality these players take on. There's a big culture about this sport where individuals can take over games and their personalities, their vendettas can take over. So I think that in certain cases, yes, there is such thing as a revenge game. You know, you see players ratchet up their intensity from maybe regular season to your playoff mode in these games if they know how to do that, if they know how to put that focus in. And so I think that in a lot of cases, yeah, there is such thing as a revenge game. There is such thing as players who find little motivations to get themselves up for games. And, you know, sometimes playing against the team that traded you, that's all the motivation you need. So I do think they exist, maybe not as openly or to the extent that NBA Twitter would like to say it does. But I do think that players get up for teams that dealt them or got rid of them in some way. And that helps motivate them to have good games.
Well, I think we saw an example of this last night between Brooklyn and Atlanta, where Atlanta won in Brooklyn over the weekend, 114-102 as a 4.5-point dog. Last night, Atlanta comes home and home set between the two teams. Atlanta's a 1-point favorite, and Brooklyn wins on the road by 20. So I think those are also situations you can look for some of those revenge games. I like to call it the rapid revenge theory, and we'll see if that comes into play with Orlando here this week, because they've got a home and home set with Atlanta coming up. Philip, I want to ask you about.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but if you look at those home and home scheduling quirks, which do happen occasionally, and actually the Magic will have a game in between their two Atlanta games, When you look at those home and home scheduling quirks, it's very, very, very rare. If I'm remembering correctly, it is pretty rare that a team sweeps the home and home in the middle of the regular season. It doesn't happen very often. I mean, if it's a lopsided matchup, it'll happen, but it's very, very, it's pretty rare when two pretty evenly matched teams don't split those home and home scheduling quirks.
No, that makes a lot of sense, and I'm not surprised to hear that you read up on something about that. I want to ask you about regression. Regression's a big thing that I look for. I love to dig into sabermetrics in baseball, and I could probably draw some Major League Baseball parallels as we go throughout this bit of the segment here. But in terms of looking for regression, whether it's positive or negative, what stats are the most important in your mind?
The most important stat to me is net rating. Essentially, net rating is the difference between your offensive rating, your points scored per 100 possessions, and your defensive rating, your points allowed per 100 possessions. Net rating is typically viewed as a better barometer of how well a team is playing than its record. I mean, there are a lot of metrics, you know, like Pythagorean wins. I think you mentioned in your notes in the email. A lot of those use net rating as a basis to kind of figure out, well, what is this team's record really? Like, statistically, what is this team's record? And so obviously there are some fluctuations there, and you obviously have to play the games, and there are outliers statistically. I mean, Washington lost by, I think, what was it, 40 last night. That's going to weigh pretty heavily against their net rating. So maybe they're not as bad as they showed that day, but that's a pretty big outlier weighing their statistics down. But in any case, when I'm looking, is this team actually as good as their record indicates? I'll look at net rating and say, oh, you know, this team is 3 or 4 games over 500, but their net rating is actually plus 0.1 or plus 0.2. That kind of suggests they're about a 500 team. So, you know, maybe they're due for a little bit of a fall. So when you find little fluctuations like that, where a team, let's say a team is on a streak where they've won 5 out of 7 games, but their net rating is maybe plus 0.5 in that stretch. Well, that would suggest that they're winning a lot of close games, and close games to me are random. I mean, essentially in most cases, a close game is going to be a coin flip. Most teams will, you know, finish around 500 in close games. There are obviously some variation there. And if you lose a lot of your close games, you're going to probably struggle. But to me, I always say this to fans who worry about good teams don't win close games. They avoid them. So when you got a team that's got a very, very high net rating, and maybe their record isn't as good as it suggests it should, that might be a sign that team is getting ready to take off again. That team's going to get ready to take off and win a lot of games to make up that difference. Or it might suggest that, you know, maybe they had one really good game and it's skewing their statistics, and they're about to come down a little bit because their record is more reflective of who they are. So you always got to kind of look more specifically and say, okay, why does this number look this way? Especially when you're looking at maybe stretches like the last 10 games, the last 5 games or so. Smaller sample sizes than maybe we're looking at the full season. I mean, when you're looking at the full season, you can kind of get a sense of where every team is at and where every team should be at by looking at this really kind of simple metric. I mean, net rating is essentially, you know, plus or minus points per 100 possessions per game, you know, in a game. So, I think that's usually the first place I look when I'm trying to figure out, well, is this team actually any good? Is this kind of that basic statistic to say, okay, this is where this team should be at. You know, even when the Magic were playing really, really well at the beginning of the season, you know, and their net rating was the second best in the league, it was like, oh, okay, you know, that it's a small sample size, that the Magic are actually playing pretty well. And, you know, slowly you started to see that drop. They actually have a negative net rating now. So, you know, you just got to kind of keep an eye out for trends and, you know, maybe, you know, limit your sample size if you're looking for those trends, but also be cognizant of what's kind of weighing those numbers down as well.
So who are some of those teams that are outliers here based on their actual win-loss record and their net rating? I mean, are there some teams you can isolate that may, you know, improve significantly over the next couple of weeks, maybe fall off a little bit? Are there any teams out there that really stand out?
Yeah, you know, so I'm looking kind of at those statistics right now. The first one that jumps off the page to me is Utah Jazz. They are currently 5th in the league overall in net rating, plus 5.2 points per 100 possessions, but they're only 13-11 on the season. This is a team that has a really strong defense at a 101 defensive rating, so they give up 101 points per 100 possessions, and their offense has surprisingly been good. So a lot of the questions with Utah is, can they sustain this offense? Can they keep their offense going at this rate? And I think that is a very, very fair question of them, especially because they're relying so heavily on a rookie in Donovan Mitchell. They're playing really, really well right now, and I think we're starting to see their record kind of jump up to reflect their net rating. At the same time, Utah also has two 40-point wins on their belt. They beat the Magic by 40 on the road. They beat Washington by 40 last night. So is that enough to skew a stat that's based off of 24 games? I don't know. But you have to kind of consider that and remember that. So, it feels like Utah is going to keep this win streak going for a little while longer. When they hit that rough spot, it'll be interesting to see how much that number falls or how deep that well goes. Another team, again, I'm just kind of looking quickly here through these net ratings. Another team that could be really interesting to watch is Milwaukee. Milwaukee's got a minus 0.1 net rating, so that essentially means they're a 500 basketball team. Yet they're 12-10 on the year. So I think, Milwaukee's a team that everyone's still trying to figure out whether they're for real, whether they'll be able to zoom up the Eastern Conference. We know that they have the talent to do so with Giannis Antetokounmpo there, adding Eric Bledsoe, rookie of the year, Malcolm Brogdon, Thon Maker's made some big strides this year. That is a team that feels like it's going to kind of take a leap at some point and take a big step this season and kind of zoom up the standings. But they haven't done it yet. And statistically, they're probably outperforming themselves a little bit.
Well, let's talk about analytics in general here. I mean, I know the Houston Rockets obviously are kind of the poster child for this. And we know Golden State's doing a lot with it as well. We sort of saw a lot of resistance in Major League Baseball. Everyone knows about the movie Moneyball and the Michael Lewis book where the Athletics were trying to find some new inefficiencies out there being a small market team. You had some teams buy in very, very quickly and say, okay, this makes sense for us. You had some teams that were like, well, we're just going to keep spending money and not really care. The big markets were kind of slow to come around on analytics in some respects. I mean, Boston came around quickly. The Cubs have come around, very quickly here over the last 10 years or so. What about in the NBA? I mean, are we starting to see, a lot more analytics in the front office, more analytics in terms of coaching decisions and hires? Do you feel like that's kind of a growing trend?
I think it's a growing trend. And I think a lot more teams are embracing it. I mean, I don't know if teams are necessarily, I don't even know how teams are using it as far as finding free agent buys and finding how players fit into their scheme. But coaches just absolutely don't mind having more information. I mean, what information they share with their players and how they present it, that's something that they're still trying to figure out. You don't want to overload the players with too much thoughts. You want to kind of keep things simple when you're dealing with your players. But almost every team in the league right now has some sort of analytics department running stats on everything in the league, keeping track of things that are of interest to the team, trying to find little advantages that maybe they're not seeing just by watching tape. I think what's really unique about the NBA is, there is a constant kind of Twitter war between the eye test guys and the analytics guy and the analytics people. But in reality, when you go to the team level, they really work hand in hand. The coaches that are really successful with analytics, they will take a look at numbers, talk to the analytics people and ask, what does this number mean? What am I looking at here? And it will confirm something that they're noticing anyway. I mean, these are smart basketball people. They know what they're looking for, and this just kind of gives them evidence of it. So I think in the NBA, especially at the coaching level, we're kind of seeing it work hand in hand. And you'll get something that surprises you, I think what's really great about the NBA is they're willing to ask, okay, what are we missing here? Why are we missing this? What aren't we seeing here? What is this number? I mean, especially the statistics people too, they'll ask, okay, this surprised me. Am I missing something? Does this number really represent what I think it means? And so I think everyone's still trying to figure out what to do with all this data. I mean, the amount of data in the NBA is incredible. I mean, I don't know how baseball does it or how baseball tracks things, but the amount of tracking that's done on NBA players in the middle of a game, even the amount of statistics you can find on the NBA's public statistics stats database is so huge. I mean, there's just so much data they're keeping track of. You're bound to find some nuggets of information or something that surprises you, something that makes you wonder, I wonder why this is the case. And then something that, of course, confirms what you might already know and only strengthens your opinion in that matter.
Now, one of the things I like to follow when it comes to Major League Baseball, I know I'm keeping you a little bit long, I apologize, but this is a fascinating concept and a fascinating development across sports for me. But one of the very interesting things in Major League Baseball is that you have some guys that are very in tune with the advanced metrics. Think about guys like Joey Votto, for example. You know, absolutely, he's a student of sabermetrics. And you have other guys that just don't care. You know, I mean, there have been stories of Eno Saris of Fangraphs going into clubhouses asking questions about analytics and virtually getting laughed at by players, almost like, you know, sort of that that high school, you know, bro culture type of thing. What is it like in the NBA? I mean, do players, you know, actively worry about these things? Do they try to educate themselves on these things? Or is it mostly, you know, done by the spreadsheet guys in the front office?
You know, I think it depends on the player. I mean, I remember a few years ago, Kirk Goldsberry did this long piece for I think it was for Grantland at the time, where Kirk Goldsberry, if you remember, I don't think he's still writing publicly anymore, but he would do those shot charts that with the heat graphs, and he would represent his data really graphically well and a really easy way to digest. And so he wrote this article where he sat down with LeBron James and went over some of the shot charts over his career. And LeBron ate that up. He loved looking at it. Like, again, it's visually very, very great to look at and visually easy to understand. But LeBron James is a guy that obsesses over everything. I mean, he's got a mind like a steel trap when it comes to basketball. Like, he'll remember very specific plays that have happened throughout his career. And so he's someone that eats up all that information. I mean, he wants all that information for every advantage he can get, which is kind of scary considering how good he is. Some players, you know, they don't care. I think it really depends on the player. And, you know, as a coach, you have to understand which players to approach with that information and which players don't need that information or need that information presented in another way. Essentially, you know, the way I've always viewed the statistics is it's a tool. It helps explain things. It might help explain things that you see and might tell you to watch for something that you may not be seeing. But really, it has to go hand in hand with everything else. You have to ask yourself, why does this number come out the way that it does, and kind of match it with what you're seeing on the floor. And if it doesn't match, you have to ask yourself, okay, what doesn't match about these things? What flaws are there in the number that's not matching what I'm seeing on the floor? What am I not noticing maybe that while I'm watching the game that would cause this number? I mean, they numbers essentially are only a reflection of reality. I mean, it's trying to take, you know, a complex thing like a basketball game and turn it into a number that can be easily understood, digested, and explained. And so you have to kind of marry the two, I think. And I think the NBA's done a pretty good job at that. You know, obviously some people don't want those numbers. They think about it too much when they get those numbers. And so a coach has to play kind of psychologist and figure out which guys respond to seeing those numbers and seeing that data, and which players don't need to see it and just need to have confidence to play their role. And the coach just has to trust that the numbers are bearing out that he's doing his job.
Just because I'm curious here on a personal level, you know, covering the Magic, being there at practices and that type of thing, have you ever approached players with, you know, an analytics-based stat and said, hey, you know, what do you think about this and that? I mean, is that something that they've been receptive to, or have you, you know, just sort of kind of kept it in your mind, used it in your writing, but not really brought it up to them?
You know, there definitely been some numbers that I've brought up to players and asked them if they kind of had an explanation for it. I earlier this year, for instance, I did an article on the Magic defense, and then I kind of came into it saying, okay, the Magic, I mean, this was earlier in the season when the Magic were playing well. I kind of went into it saying, you know, the Magic are currently ranked fifth defensively. When I watched them play, I was like, this is not a defense that's ranked fifth defensively. I thought there were a lot of problems. And so I wanted to ask, you know, the coaching staff and some of the players, you know, what's been working defensively for you guys? Why is this number the way it is? And what do you still need to see improved? And you know, I asked Frank Vogel that. I was like, you know, the team's ranked fifth in defensive rating. What's been working about the defense? And his first line was, you know, we're not playing like a top five defense in my mind, but we have a lot of work we need to do. And so, you know, yeah, you'll sometimes, you know, when I kind of approach a team about a stat, it's more like, okay, I see this number and I trust this number, especially defensive rating. I have my own observations, but I want to know what the player's observations are about that. And so I may not necessarily present them directly with the stat, or I may say, the statistics early in the season are saying this, you know, what are you seeing? Like, I want to get there. When I approach a player with a statistic, I don't really want to know necessarily how they kind of, what they think about where they rank or something. I want to know what they're seeing out there or what insight they can add to explain that number from their perspective. And, you know, for the most part, if they're doing well at it, they'll say, yeah, no, it's great that, you know, that I'm there, but, you know, they'll kind of explain a little bit more, you know, cause they'll have a little bit more perspective. Like, when I try, you know, especially when I'm approaching a player, you know, I want to take a number that I'm basing my article off of and add sort of that eye test that the player has. Like, what are they seeing to kind of explain this number? And then I can add my own observations to it as well.
Very interesting. Very fascinating. It's something I've always kind of wondered. And, you know, I mean, it's different for everybody. It's different for every organization because some organizations just are more well-versed in advanced metrics and others aren't. And it's kind of a fine line that you have to walk as somebody that does cover the team as a media member. So, appreciate your candid answer there with that. Philip Rosenreich from OrlandoMagicDaily.com, also contributor to the Step Back and Talking 10. Anything you've written recently you want to point our listeners towards?
You know, I'm getting ready to do my first quarter review for the Orlando Magic, so I'll be handing out a first quarter MVP award, as well as looking ahead to the second quarter of the season, which has already started, and then I'll be posting something up on the Step Back hopefully later today. It's been a while since I've written for them, so I'm gonna talk a little bit more about the sophomore class in the NBA.
And of course, all your work can be found on your Twitter account at @PhilR². Philip, thank you so much for joining us, man. We really appreciate it. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for having me on again, as always.
Really, really good segment there. I enjoyed that a lot. I enjoyed talking about analytics in some of these different sports, especially where I don't fully understand the statistics. I mean, I know them in baseball like the back of my hand. I've been paying more attention to them in football and in the NHL. But basketball, a little bit of a unexplored frontier for me. So I'm happy to get some thoughts there from Philip on that on today's show. Coming up on our Wednesday edition of Bang the Book Radio, two guests will join us. The first, Brian Leonard from WagerTalk.com. Excuse me. The second, Wes Reynolds, for our Wednesday Wagering with Wes Reynolds segment. Thursday, Brad Powers and Rolf Michaels. Friday, I'm going to force Joe Everett to join me for the Westgate Super Contest selection segment off of my 4-in-1 week. And then also Brent from DSI Sportsbook with this week's version of the odds report. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.